Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 25 years of law enforcement analysis experience, intelligence experience with Army, Navy, Phoenix Police Department, and the FBI. He is currently a licensed private investigator for security intelligence integration. He's here to talk about, among other things, cryptocurrency fraud. Please welcome Brennan Long. Brennan, how are we doing?
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the invite to jump on your show.
Yeah, there you have quite a career here, and there's so much to go over. I am fascinated to get your journey and get your perspective on the law enforcement analysis profession.
Absolutely. I enjoyed the journey thus far. I'm still going.
Awesome. All right. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I almost fell into it, if you will. So if you can go back 25 years, and for those of us that are still in the profession, I had graduated from Ball State University with a degree in criminal justice and decided, you know, I didn't want to join the local sheriff's department and become a deputy. So what can I do? And, you know, throughout high school and kind of college, I'd always kind of thought I'd aim to get into the FBI. I always wanted to be an FBI agent and so on. But I knew that you had to have at least 3 years of work experience in something after you graduated to even be considered or to put in an application with the FBI. So I thought, well, how am I going to start this journey? And upon graduation, it's kind of a funny story. I was moving out to Phoenix, Arizona, and thought to myself, I got to find a job. And I had applied to be a youth correctional drill instructor. And looking back, Jason, I got to say it was a blessing in disguise. I did not get that job. So I had to keep looking around, and I saw an ad in the paper for a volunteer position with the Phoenix Police Department. And the volunteer position was part-time. It was in the researched in statistical analysis section at the department there. And I decided, well, you know, I got to try to get my foot in the door. I got to figure out what direction I want to aim for. And I applied. And luckily, I got that volunteer role. And nice. That kind of kicked off my career, believe it or not. And I was in that role for about 6 months. Again, I was working part-time on a volunteer basis, and that allowed me to kind of get a little bit of training in criminal intelligence analysis here and there from RIMIN, from Rocky Mountain Information Network, if folks know about RISNET and so on.
Yeah.
And so this is going way back when, but, you know, about a week's worth of training and having my foot in the door, they had an intelligence analyst position open up in the gang unit about 6 months later. And I applied for it. And that kind of started my journey back in 97, 98.
Man. So then you were a civilian your whole time there at Phoenix Police Department.
Yes.
All right.
And I've been a civilian my whole time, my whole career. And I'll kind of jump back into that if we talk about the private investigation side. But yeah, I was never sworn, never a badge carrier. In and out of all the different careers I've had, I've always been an analyst.
Right. And so I'm curious, because we're going to get to the impact on your career path with 9/11. But at this time, when you're going through training and you're dealing with the risk centers and just learning the law enforcement intelligence analysis career, I mean, how different was it pre-9/11? Because I tell folks, I was analyst exactly 1 week prior to 9/11.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, again, we were kind of discussing this yesterday, kind of getting ready for the show. You know, back then when I took that training with RIMIN, We didn't have a lot of software at the Phoenix Police Department or even in the field itself. The only folks that really had some analytical software was the Department of Defense and some of these big police departments. And so when I went through training, we used to joke it was pencils and stencils. And so we went through scenarios and they'd say, okay, we're gonna create some link charts. And they would hand out stencils and pencils. Yeah. And you would draw your circles. You would kind of use the ruler to get a straight edge to connect your entities. And, you know,
but don't cross the lines.
Right. So it was an interesting time. And I think that back then, what I have realized is I've kind of made my way across the country in different positions. The Southwest back then was kind of on the cutting edge of intelligence analysis. When my area, the Phoenix Police Department, Mesa Police Department, Tempe, they all had analysts or crime analysts and had a chapter, an ILEA chapter. They had a IACA chapter. And so it was kind of cutting edge. And the other major city close to us at the time that had analysts was San Diego. And what I've realized, and we might get back to it, as I've made my way east, I've noticed that, you know, not until recently, and we're talking 20 years plus years later, are some of these major police departments bringing on professional analysts in non-sworn positions. So it's been interesting to see, and it was interesting to kind of be there, if you will, in the beginning.
Yeah, it's fascinating when I think back to it, because it's almost like buying a house in a neighborhood before the neighborhood just becomes really popular and expensive, right?
Sure. Like
picking the profession and getting into this profession. You were just a couple of years ahead of 9/11. I was 1 week ahead. And that initial, right after there, obviously a lot of changes happen, a lot of money, a lot of training comes up in the aughts that, you know, we were on that beginning part of that wave. And
yes,
it is interesting to think about it and just how much has changed and how much spotlight has come on to the task of being an analyst at various law enforcement entities throughout the country.
Yes, absolutely. And there were folks around like Arizona DPS back then had analysts. And again, when I got hired with the Phoenix Police Department, there were already two analysts. But, you know, a lot of it was, again, we were doing link charts, but a lot of it was maintaining databases. Back then, gangs was a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And so we were not only, you know, creating charts and connecting dots and so on and so forth, but we were also maintaining gang databases and being responsible for the purge and maintenance of that. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, kind of develops and comes into play as we get through our conversation today in information sharing and so on. And so, you know, we kind of had hybrid roles a little bit, and I think departments didn't really know how to use us. And, you know, we would create a lot of hierarchy charts and takedown charts and that sort of thing. And I remember as an analyst, well, we know this guy knows how to use a computer and we know he can hook up a projector. So let's bring him to court so he could push buttons and show a slideshow during a homicide trial. So,
Put me out a poster on that plotter.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, and trying to get the money to pay for a plotter, because everybody kind of looked at you like, what do we need that for? But you're right, Jason. It has grown leaps and bounds, and the professionalism and the career paths is just exploded. And it's kind of an exciting time. And it's exciting to see, you know, when we first started, the training that was kind of offered just in law enforcement circles, universities now offer programs and classes. And so it's good to see.
Oh, yeah. And the data, it's funny. I haven't really heard that concept of data silos in a while. It's something that definitely in the early 2000s, right after 9/11, that was something that you heard probably at almost every conference that you went to, every training that you went to. And it is different today, although there are similar problems, right? You have a ton of data now, and now you have to figure out which, even finding out about the data and still getting access to all this data. It's multiplied in some ways, trying to navigate through all this.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that from an analyst's perspective, to have access to your department's data is huge. And again, you know, we talk about some departments are on the cutting edge, depending on who really, and let's be honest, it comes down to who's head of the IT department and how they build their tables and so on and how you can access it. But I still think that when you start to talk about multi-jurisdictional crime, I think we still have data silos. And, you know, based on my experience, when I would go out and about when I was in the FBI and go to local detective meetings, I could still hear the pains of, you know, we don't have ways to share data or ways to track people across multiple jurisdictions. And even if a county went to one records management system, it was still up to each police department within that contract whether or not they'd share their data. So I think in some aspects, Jason, I think you're right. We're at a time when technology is available and easily put into place. I think we still kind of run into a little bit of data silos. And I think I've come to the realization after 25 years that we may never get to 100%. But what I've noticed is, as analysts, we tend to understand each other and have no issues in sharing data. So I think that's always our banner to take into battle between analysts and intel shops to get that done.
Yeah, that is a good point, because you still have those barriers with different departments, because there's, 17,000-18,000 police departments in the United States. So you are still dealing with that. And I still have people on the show saying, like, yeah, we didn't get all the crimes in the series because the person was jumping around from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. All right. Well, this brings us to your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is a career-defining case or project that an analyst works. And for you, this is 2001, you're at the Phoenix Police Department, and you come across a baby formula case.
Well, right. Again, I was more thrown into the baby formula case. So yes, it was soon after 9/11, and it was an interesting time in Phoenix, because if you know the history of the 19 hijackers and how that case kind of came around and what took place there afterwards, there was a cell that flew into the Pentagon that lived and operated around the Phoenix area, and they actually got their flight training at Embry-Riddle University north of Phoenix. And so as 9/11 had occurred, and the police department basically, again, it was fairly new, stood up kind of a tactical operations center to start taking in leads and citizen tips and so on, there was a bigger and a stronger tie than with the FBI in Phoenix. Prior to that, gangs was a big issue, and we had a couple detectives from the Phoenix Police Department over on a task force, but they had been working gangs and violent crime. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, a lot of us found ourselves thrust into working terrorist cases overnight. There was only so many squads at the FBI that could do things, so many analysts. And so the defining moment for me is they brought me over there to help work a case. And it was a task force of Phoenix Police Department detectives, Tempe detectives, and they assigned one agent to kind of oversee us. And it kind of interesting, fast forward real quick, that agent's name is George Pirro, who later in his career, he was the one that interviewed and interrogated Saddam Hussein.
Oh, wow.
So this case was kind of a badge case for a lot of us back then. So they assigned me to the Phoenix Police Department to work this case. And what we had found out, and it was based on a case that had been opened over there, there was a group of gentlemen who were selling stolen baby formula through, they had a WIC store, if you're familiar with WIC, and they were selling baby formula, and proceeds from that were being used to support different terrorist related activities and going into kind of that terrorist finance umbrella. And so this was all fairly new to us. I mean, suddenly, as from the Phoenix Police Department, you were thrust into kind of an international case, certainly one that touched on the cell that was operating around Phoenix, but also one that funded and provided funding for terrorist activity and groups around the world. So it was an interesting case. And as we worked this case and got rolling on it and looked at the financial aspects of it and went through bank records, and we had an IRS agent that joined our team so we could start tracking where this stuff went. The detectives were working on an undercover baby formula case with Walmart. And so we brought an investigator in from Walmart and, you know, kind of cut to the chase of all the details. We ended up standing up a controlled buy of quote unquote stolen baby formula. It was a pallet of baby formula that Walmart had donated. And they did this controlled buy to this criminal network out way out in Quartzsite, Arizona. And I don't know, Jason, if you know Arizona well.
No, I don't.
California. But Quartzsite is right on the border and it is literally in the middle of nowhere. The only other thing Quartzsite's known for than the desert is, I guess, about a month out of the year, they have a huge RV gathering that's kind of like a flea market kind of thing for a month.
Yeah.
But once that's done, there's nothing but sand in Quartzsite, Arizona. So they did this controlled buy of and transferred stolen baby formula over to this network, who eventually took it into California, to LA, to a store in LA, and they were able to get them for interstate transportation of stolen goods. And that kind of kicked off my career in intelligence. Certainly 9/11 was a catalyst, but this first case really got me going down the road that kind of led, you know, 23, 25 years later through all these different agencies and assignments and so on.
Yeah. Now, are you even at this time, you mentioned bank records, are you looking at anything with the phones?
Yes. Yes, we certainly had phones. We had bank records. They didn't, I'm trying to think back to some of the other activities that we had, but yes, we definitely had to analyze all the communications and the phone toll analysis that we did, again, the financial records, and bring that all into the case for sure.
I got you. So did this particular group, did they have any ties to terrorism?
They did. They had monetary ties. I will put it that way, where they donated money and that money eventually went into a pool that helped fund these different groups and then went on, you know, as it goes overseas, it disappears. You can only assume after it goes beyond the United States that it's funding different things. But that was their main tie, was the monetary donations that they had made to support the cause.
So how does this case change your path? Because it's about a year later that you moved to Colorado Springs and for a new position. So did that steer you in a direction like, oh, I want to be doing more types of tactical analysis? Or did it was just one of those things, the Colorado gig was just something that came across your desk one day?
No, I think that obviously I started off my career in gangs, which was certainly exciting in and of itself. But adding the terrorist cases and the work with the federal government kind of opened up a different path for me. I had started looking around, you know, I thought after 9/11, I've kind of got a feel and an interest in working more international sort of cases, more federal cases, if you will. And that having that experience at the FBI kind of gave me that, put that idea in my head. And of course, 9/11 kind of broke open the intel field for more career paths. And so as I started looking around and seeing what was out there, I knew I wanted to work with the federal government. And I found these law enforcement analysts positions is what they were titled up in Colorado Springs with the Department of Defense. And I'm not sure if you know much about U.S. Northern Command, but that was similar to like DHS. U.S. Northern Command was built essentially and developed as a response to 9/11. And they decided that the Department of Defense wanted what they call a combatant command that was in charge of Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And because of that, obviously you've got the United States in there. You've got some interesting Department of Defense and law enforcement overlap. And so they brought in law enforcement analysts to kind of come into that sphere to help them figure out almost like a liaison position. How do we work with law enforcement and how do we work with law enforcement intelligence and also kind of augment the Department of Defense that had the responsibility of safeguarding Canada, the United States, and Mexico? So that's kind of how that FBI, kind of the dabbling with the FBI there in Phoenix kind of led to opening up a new path for me.
So it's fascinating because not only is you're coming in new, it's a brand new position. It's all multiple jurisdictions who it's all new to everybody else. And so I guess when you look back at it, just what were some of the things that you remember about how the whole thing came together and maybe some setbacks or some success? What do you think about when you think about this time?
Yeah, certainly it was different. And it was trying out, again, these new relationships that have really never been levied before. And in the Department of Defense, obviously, you've got NCIS and Air Force OSI and so on, and Army CID, who likely had worked with law enforcement in their own capacities. But now we're looking at law enforcement and the Department of Defense working in a capacity around international terrorism. And that was fairly new. When I go back to the Phoenix Police Department, the greatest threat on our radar were patriot groups that were anti-government patriot groups. And we were looking at within, because the last major event had been Oklahoma City bombing. And so, you know, as we all do, we kind of react to the last major thing. And no one had really considered the first World Trade Center bombing as a significant threat to the rest of the nation. And so, again, this was all new. And then 9/11 happens, and you have to kind of figure out that suddenly local law enforcement is thrust into a position where they're closer to international events and closer to international crime, closer to international terrorism. And so again, you know, Jason, as we talk about the beginnings of this, it was a learning environment for just about everybody and trying to figure out how do you work in a world where the Department of Defense can't necessarily collect or do cases on U.S. citizens because of the Posse Comitatus Act, but how do they work with law enforcement so that they can track individuals overseas? And so it was a defining time where we had to invent, if you will, a means of, we talk about data silos, information silos, break that down for national security.
So wasn't that part of the Patriot Act that
Yes.
established that communication between law enforcement and defense?
Yes. And finding out a way to do that without stepping on the rights of U.S. citizens. And so it was an interesting time, an interesting decade right after 9/11 of trying to figure out that all out. And one of the things that I kind of a funny story, I'll take you back to 9/11. Mm-hmm. When I was pulling out of the driveway, the second tower was being hit and I rushed to work. And again, we stood up a tactical operations center through the Organized Crime Bureau, and we were bringing in information and tips from citizens. Well, the FBI sent over as a liaison an FBI agent, and we kept seeing on CNN, hey, there's 19 hijackers. We're looking for 19 hijackers, and that's going across ticker tape, and the reporters are talking about it. And we turned to this FBI agent. We said, hey, can we get the list of the 19 hijackers so that we can start to look for them in the Phoenix area? And he reached back to his office, and his office replied, we'll reach out to headquarters and we'll get you an answer. Well, we waited about an hour, and we saw the names flash on CNN before the FBI was able to get permission to share that with us. Fast forward to now, I think that that information is shared almost immediately, depending on the situation and what's going on. And so I saw that develop as well. You know, we talk about information sharing. It has gotten a lot better than what it was in the early 2000s. And I think from an intelligence standpoint, sharing that information as well. So again, we kind of go back to where were we and where are we now? I think that we, leaps and bounds, are much better at that.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward a little bit then. And so you are with the Department of Defense there for until 2009, and then you finally going down what you originally dreamed of was working with the FBI. And so at this time you get assigned to the Chicago field office as an intelligence analyst.
Correct. And yeah, my contract came to an end with the Department of Defense, and I decided I had to find a new career. And at the time, the FBI was direct hiring intel, those with intel backgrounds, and the Bureau was expanding its intelligence capabilities and bringing on a lot more analysts. And so I landed in Chicago, and my first assignment was with the human intelligence squads. And these squads are agents that go out and basically collect information and also are really trained in developing sources for different criminal programs, terrorist programs, counterintelligence, and so on. And so as an analyst, I wasn't necessarily doing the link charts, flow charts, telephone toll analysis, and that sort of thing. I was reviewing backgrounds of individuals and creating almost what I would call interview packets, and then going out with the agents in interviewing these individuals, bringing questions that we wanted to answer for different programs out with them on interviews, and then ultimately developing those individuals for either, you could call them informants or sources for different squads. And so that was a unique experience as well in learning kind of what the operation side does, what an investigator does, a detective or an agent does in terms of sitting in with them during an interview. And I think that was a very rewarding experience.
Yeah, that's you're getting out of the data realm a little bit, getting into human intelligence there, having to actually talk to people.
yes, right. And you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, I say this in jest with 25 years behind me. You know, analysts, we tend to want to sit at our desk and get behind the computer and move data around and so on and come up with conclusions. But I always encouraged my analysts when I became a supervisor to get out there and do anything you can to get in a car, go to a crime scene, go to an interview, whatever it is, with your investigators, with your detectives, with your agents, because it gives you a window into operation and how they operate, how they develop cases, what they would need from you when they get back to the office. And I think that makes you a very well-rounded analyst, and you start to think proactively even before your investigators or detectives need the information. You've already done the work and have it for them. And I think that's a really big key to success is maintaining that and learning how to do that.
Yeah, but it really goes back to the data explosion too. Like, you just have to develop, network, and understand what's out there. So when you need it, you know that you have it. If that makes any sense. I don't know if that's the best grammatically correct way of saying but that's definitely what you need to do.
Yes, you have to expose yourself to just about everything that's out there. And, you know, again, when you go to conferences and you see these vendors that are selling different tools, stop and play around with it, or see if they'll give you a free trial and play around with it. And even if your department can't afford it, you at least know it's out there and you know what its capabilities are. And eventually, you know, you hope that you can bring something on board that, if it's not that software, it's something similar, and gives you an idea on how to dig through the information that we're kind of overloaded with.
Hi, this is Scott Eicher, and I am a retired FBI agent, and I just wanted to point out that FBI agents are people too.
This is Erin Wickersham from Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and my public service announcement is to go on a court along. You may have been on a ride along, and I think someone else recommended a 911 operator sit along. So find a prosecutor in your jurisdiction and see if you can go to court with them. You'll learn a lot about the process and about the work that they're doing.
This is Michelle Snow, and just want you to remember to build trust with integrity.
Speaking of conferences, more and more I'm seeing on analytical conferences, analysts presenting on live events, and whether that is a riot or active shooting, some kind of active event going on, and the analyst role for that. Your other analyst badge story deals with working the 2012 NATO conference for the FBI.
Yeah, and I think that's, Jason, I think it's a great point. You know, again, we go back to the late 90s, we were doing link charts and flow charts and hierarchy charts and so on. And again, using the plotter, that guy knows how to use the plotter, go ask him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the role has turned hybrid as more and more departments and agencies are looking for not only the lead up to, but during the event, real-time monitoring of threat activity. And, you know, my experience with the FBI there in Chicago, obviously Chicago has tons of major events that take place in the city. This particular one was the NATO conference in 2012, which required us to spin up and kind of prepare 12 to 18 months in advance. And a major component of that was intelligence. And we knew prepping for this event that we were going to have a lot of protesters. It was actually supposed to be the NATO and G8 summit at the same place, one right after another. But during, I can't remember if it was about a year out, they decided to move the G8 summit to a more secluded location because they got such a massive amount of threats that we knew were coming to the city from all over the nation, protesters and so on, anarchists. And so there was a lot of prepping for that and gaining a better understanding of, is this, it's not necessarily, again, working a case, but now I'm working a threat. And because of that, and because of the chances of individuals coming from the suburbs, we started to bring in analysts from suburban police departments. I think a major one was Naperville PD, which is about 20 miles, give or take, west of Chicago. There were some analysts up north from other suburban locations. And so they all were brought in and brought into the intelligence committee, essentially. And we were looking at threats quarterly and then leading up to the event monthly. And then they were brought in to monitor things real time with us. And I think that's really exciting that that role kind of takes on different nuances as we've gone, and grown as an intelligence professional over the last 20 years.
So with that, what did you take away from that? What was something like, oh, if we do this again, we need to do X, Y, and Z?
Sure. I guess this is my pedestal or my soapbox today. Information sharing was huge. And so we learned that we have to share information early and off, but then also identifying and working. And I think this is important to reach out to the analysts that are in your area, create that relationship so that when you have an event that's multi-jurisdictional or you have an event that's a major threat in the area, you can reach out to each other. And you can, I like to say, you have the intel speak where the investigative arms in these agencies and departments don't necessarily know, again, the data and the techniques, where in the intelligence side as an analyst, you know that. You know what you can get, where you can get it, and you know the network of other analysts to help you out. And so I think that's a lesson learned that, you know, there's a lot of chapters of ILEA and so on in IACA out there. I think it, if nothing else, you get together with these chapters, join these chapters, get to know each other, because if there is a major event, you can pick up the phone and you know who to call.
Yeah. All right. It was about last year there that you decided to leave the FBI and get into the position that you are now. You went on to become a supervisor of analysts and had a great career with the FBI. If there's anything you want to add to that, you certainly can. But I'm also curious, how'd you know it was time to leave the FBI?
Sure. There were certain things that when I was in the FBI, the last 2 years in Chicago and the last few years in Cleveland, where I was going out and going to gang meetings and detective meetings in the suburbs. And I'm sure many of the listeners have done that themselves. And I realized that when you're out there and you're sitting with these police departments, one of the things is they don't have if they don't have an assigned analyst, they don't have that capability to do that kind of work by themselves. They may dabble in it, but they've got so many cases and so on. And so I really wanted to kind of focus on helping local law enforcement with intelligence. And that kind of drew me out of the FBI and into the private sector to work with different departments and work on cases, if you will, as a private investigator to kind of help that, where I saw an overwhelming issue where these detectives work in multi-jurisdictional crime were kind of buried. And that kind of drew me out into the private sector. As a private investigator, you know, what's interesting to me is, again, I kind of go back to, if you're an analyst in a police department, try and get one foot into operation. Understand how cases are developed. See if you can go to an interview if they'll let you go. Go out to an interview, see how evidence is collected, see how the case is put together. Go sit with them as they present it to the prosecutor. And again, I think that makes you a better analyst in that you know what is needed. But then when you get into, and again, I wasn't afraid to get my private investigator's license because one, I knew the databases. We have databases just like law enforcement have databases that we can run information in. So I knew I could learn or get access to those databases. And I had stepped into and knew the operational side, even though I wasn't a sworn officer. And so I felt confident that I could do the work of a private investigator. And I'll give you an example. So, you know, just in the last month, I was called out to work an insurance fraud case, and I had to sit down and do recorded statements and interview these individuals, write that up, submit the files, do the research, again, go into the databases and find that information that would enhance the case. And so I think it's an interesting career path. And when I started to go out there and network with other private investigators in other states, I'm seeing more and more former law enforcement intelligence analysts in this profession. And so I think that you don't necessarily have to narrow yourself to just intelligence or being an analyst. There are a lot of things beyond law enforcement where you're still working in the field that you can do. So I kind of, if you're looking to have a varied career track, you know, certainly keep it in mind.
So are your clients that you're working with, are they private citizens hiring you? Is that how that works?
Yes, or private companies. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't really touch on it, and we certainly can. On the cryptocurrency side, I started to get an understanding of cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency fraud. And there is a huge gap between what local law enforcement knows, is able to do in terms of tracking and tracing cryptocurrency, and what the federal government is able to cover. Right now, we're at a period where there are so many cryptocurrency fraud scams going on and cases that it's overwhelming the federal government and they just can't cover it all. So as a private investigator, you're able to have the tools, do the tracking and tracing where you are hired by a victim, you put the case together, and then you're marketing, if you will, or presenting that case to local law enforcement and to prosecutors. And so I say in some cases, obviously, we're hired from the private sector side, but you still have a lot of interaction with law enforcement, even as a private investigator.
Yeah. So let's get into the cryptocurrency aspect of it, because it just makes me, you know, as we've talked about this, it just, you talked about what was in front of you in the late 90s, early 2000s. You just one of those things that how far we've come to, you know, studying something. Fraud alone has always been there, but now you have this whole other element. And as you said, just cryptocurrency fraud alone is too big for the feds to handle.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I kind of go back to seeing this evolve over the last 20 years. You know, when I worked gangs in the late 90s on the streets of Phoenix, if you will, a lot of the gangs were street centric. They would hang out on their street. They really didn't go to other streets. They maybe a neighborhood, but you were focused on crime within Phoenix. And 9/11 kind of broke that open, where now you have to have your aperture has to widen, where you are more cognizant of what's taking place on an international level. And I think cryptocurrency is another door that has opened that is making those international connections to local communities and local police departments that we've never seen before. It's so easy for someone overseas in Thailand or Singapore or what have you to scam somebody in a rural town in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And how does that local police department respond to that? And, you know, it's been an interesting year or so as I've started to work this issue and speaking to different police departments about it. Again, a lot of them don't have analysts. One, they don't know what cryptocurrency is, which is fine. I mean, it's a fairly new way to exchange assets and so on. So not a lot of people know how it works, if you will. And then how do I investigate it when I'm a rural community, rural police department in Indiana, and the individual that's committed this crime is sitting in Laos. I mean, this is federal government stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, going after the criminal is one thing, but going after and trying to recover the assets is another. And that's where local, county, state law enforcement can get involved, and they can understand, one, cryptocurrency and how it works, but understand the tracking and tracing tools in trying to find the assets that were fraudulently taken from these victims that are in their communities, and then present that to their local prosecutor who files the court order to a cryptocurrency exchange to get those assets returned. So I guess, as you know, we discussed this, it's not only getting a better understanding of it, and as an analyst, you know, if you're an analyst on a department, you're going to be the first line that, one, they're going to come to gain a better understanding of what this is, and two, how to track and trace it. You know how to do toll analysis. You know how to manipulate data. How do you find these assets in the crypt in the blockchain? And so I think, as kind of a suggestion, and as we kind of move forward, I don't think it's on the agenda for this conferences this year, but I think it certainly will be in the next couple of years, is as an analyst working cryptocurrency and understanding who owns different wallets and where these assets are going. And again, I think it's another catalyst of local communities, local departments now having to be more aware of things that are taking place on an international level, like transnational organized crime.
Yeah. So is it easier to recover the cryptocurrency or get the perpetrator punished across overseas?
Well, it certainly is easier to get the recovery, especially when these exchanges have either satellite offices in the United States or they are in the United States. It's simply getting, I say simply, quote unquote, getting a court order and submitting that to those exchanges to identify the fraudulent activity, identify the assets in question, and then getting that pulled back from those wallets that those exchanges have that they're responsible for, and then getting that back to the victim. Finding a perpetrator overseas, I think Laos is a good example, and everybody's heard about the Nigerian schemes. I think those are good examples of, you know, if you can even identify the person, getting the extradition to bring that back to the United States to prosecute them is probably a huge endeavor, and not something obviously that someone from a rural police department, again, in Indiana, or even the Chicago Police Department, for that matter, is going to do. They're going to push that responsibility over to the federal agencies to take care of that.
So one of the advantages of cryptocurrency is that you do see the history of Bitcoin, so to speak, and that yes. you can sit there and look at the entire history of who had this cryptocurrency throughout its life. And so I would imagine you talked about the recovery and getting that aspect of getting it recovered, but I would imagine that as these folks are frauding folks and getting this, that they're instantly selling that cryptocurrency. It's not like they're holding on to it. So probably by the time you get around to saying like, okay, this is a fraud, it needs to be recovered back to the original person, that cryptocurrency could be traded multiple times to people that have no idea that it was obtained illegally at some point.
Yeah, I think, you know, to some extent, you'd be surprised that, and I'll put it in kind of simplistic terms, some of these international networks are pushing this cryptocurrency, a lack of a better term, into a holding tank. And you'd be surprised at where those holding tanks are and where they sit with national and international exchanges. So sometimes you can trace it back to a wallet that's sitting on an exchange where you can send that quarter to the exchange and get the amount recovered. Because it's, you know, Jason, you kind of go back to the 80s and 90s where drug cartels were having a hard time converting money, dollar bills, into legitimate funds, right? They were having a hard time getting that money converted into a banking system where they could then move it around and legitimately use it. It's not that much different in the cryptocurrency world in the blockchain. And why some of these locations are kind of a storage site for Bitcoin or Ethereum that they have collected from all of these victims, because they're still trying to figure out a way how to get it out into hard currency. And so in 100% of the cases, but a lot of cases you can track it to kind of a holding tank, again, if you will, in a simplistic term. But the other way is monitoring those wallets that are often being used to move this and be ready to pop that court order when that the number of losses come through there that you can recover from the individuals conducting that fraud.
All right, good. So a couple more questions on this. So what do you wish police chiefs knew about cryptocurrency?
Well, I think one thing that, you know, when I would go to chief chapters, if you will, that they have a lot of communities or counties have chiefs of police chapter, I think the one thing that I notice is it's hard. Again, you're a superintendent level to understand the tools of the trade after you've not done investigations for a while. You're now in the admin part of that department. And so I think what I would push to police chiefs is to have an open mind to, one, bring in individuals that can provide presentations on what cryptocurrency is and how it would affect your department and your community, and then allow for your analysts and detectives to go to the training and get a better idea on how to track and trace this, and then see where there are ways to, you know, and obviously it all depends on how many cases are coming through, but see what are the ways to either work with the software, the tools that are available, or to exploit the ways online for your cases. I think as the world moves more and more closer to digital currency, it's going to be a major issue and it's going to hit almost every police department. We talk about fraud, but let's talk about illicit funds being gained from drug trafficking, gun trafficking, other schemes that are then funneling back into the community, and they're using cryptocurrency to do that. I'd be willing to bet Jason, if I plugged your hometown into Google, I could probably find at least one cryptocurrency ATM that's available in your community where you can take these illicit proceeds from drug sales, throw it into that ATM, send it into the blockchain, and now move that easily wherever you want. So I think understanding those techniques and how they're being utilized is going to be important in the next several years.
Yeah. Okay. I guess similar question. What would you tell analysts about cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I would say anything and everything that you can find to at least get educated on what it is and how it's used and how it functions and the methods that are being used to move it around. There's certainly articles out there, and I think there's a lot of stuff on YouTube these days to get at least a cursory level understanding of it. And I think, again, you're going to start seeing it pop up at conferences and things. But if you can find training that's one day to a week and you can get your department to pay for it, it's well worth gaining that knowledge and to be in front of that threat as the digital currency comes online.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just watching somebody, and I think it was a comedian. He says it's the biggest pyramid scheme ever. That's what he called cryptocurrency. It's like, yeah, who's going to be left holding the bag at the end? That's basically what they think this is. So.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's got more legs than I thought it would. I would have thought it would have collapsed years ago, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, and I think what's interesting is, you know, in law enforcement, we tend to be skeptical by nature.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the news, anything that involves a scam or something, you know, going south is going to be in the media and gain a lot of attention. You know, I was talking to a detective about cryptocurrency, and we had a phone conversation for about an hour, and he was not familiar with it at all. And I said, well, remember, we're exposed to probably 1-5% of the frauds and schemes and everything else that people are using cryptocurrency for. 95% of the blockchain and cryptocurrency is legitimate transactions that we're not exposed to because we don't see the crime. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you're going to see is countries take this on. The leaders right now, I think the UK, Dubai, I think Singapore are really pushing this. And here in the United States, we're trying to come up with regulations to help with it. But, you know, if you Google it, there's already conversations taking place and research being done on how to digitize the dollar. So it's as much as we want to think it's going away. Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not a young man anymore, and sometimes technology hurts my brain, but I have to understand, you know, how to program the VCR. Yeah. Or else I'm going to be left behind.
Yeah. Well, you use VCR, so that shows your age already.
So. Right.
So, all right. So in terms of some other advice for our listeners, we talked yesterday, you'd mentioned target-centric approaches in law enforcement analysis for intelligence analysts based on a book from Robert Clark.
Yes.
So just talk a little bit about that and why you recommend it for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think not only the technique, but I think the mindset that comes with understanding target-centric approaches. And Clark really does a really good job of going through and explaining the technique and how to utilize it. And I hate to say it, Jason, it makes the hair on the back of my neck kind of stand up. I'm not a big fan of the law enforcement words, buzzwords that are out there, intelligence-led or data-driven. And there's a reason behind that. If you've picked up on it, I really emphasize a lot of collaboration with operations and your detectives. And when you come out with a term, and most of these folks by nature are type A personalities. So when you come into a room and say, you know, this is an intelligence-led endeavor, you're automatically going to, one, close their minds down and lose a little bit of some coordination there because they're thinking you're running the case. okay? Or you're running the program or what have you. And so I'm not a big fan of those buzzwords. What I am a fan of and what the target-centric approach does is it really kind of builds upon intel and operations integration, where everybody is part of this team. The analyst doesn't sit off in some other room. Everybody's part of this team mentally and maybe even physically, and feeding this case, feeding this problem from both sides. And it's integrated in the center. And that's where that target-centric approach comes from. The analyst is feeding from one side, the investigator or detective feeding from the other, and it's all centered on one problem. And I think that's a much better approach and easier to integrate with your operations than some of these other methodologies. And a lot of these, you know, I'll throw this out there, it's F3EAD, and I won't go through what the acronym stands for, but you can look it up. It's a military methodology of doing that exact same thing. And it's interesting if you're to Google that and just read through it. Again, it's military centric, but it's not, you know, I'm not asking someone to bring in a military operation into their department. What I'm asking you is to understand the mindset and the methodology and then apply that into your department at whatever level. And I think you'll find that you start to meld a little bit better with your investigators if you have that approach.
All right, good. And we'll put some links in the show notes if folks are interested in some of this stuff, and they can also help them get more information. So, all right, Brennan, let's finish up with personal interests. Beyond being a family man now, you describe yourself as a Dungeons and Dragons gamer. So.
Yeah. So, you know, this is going way back. Again, I'm dating myself a little bit, but in the 80s and early 90s, Dungeons and Dragons. So where I grew up in Wisconsin, the creator and developer of Dungeons and Dragons lived close by. And so it actually came onto the scene in our state a little bit faster, maybe so than others. But I started getting into Dungeons and Dragons when I was in middle school and the role-playing games. Mm-hmm. And what I found interesting when I look back, you know, and again, I say this in jest, you know, not a lot of guys that were in sports were into Dungeons and Dragons. So we were kind of labeled for a while as, you know, those are the guys that play board games and they're not into basketball. Mm-hmm. But where I appreciate having gone through that phase is the ability to use your mind, the creativity that are in those role-playing games, and the interaction you have with people. And I think, you know, Jason, you had mentioned a little bit earlier, you develop human intelligence skills. And I miss those days. I wish I had the time again outside of the family to sit down and play those role-playing games and strategic games and so on. But I think it's an interesting way to get your mind thinking in a certain direction, certain techniques and ways to interact with other people are those games.
Yeah, it's interesting. My son started playing it a couple years ago, and he actually was the dungeon master to a couple of his campaigns. And I told him, I just think, keep the end in mind. Whatever it is, like, if you want to, wherever you want them to go at the end, have that end in mind, because it's something that takes multiple meetings usually to get through an entire campaign. So you want to make sure that you keep the end in mind for that.
Yes, yes. And I think it's an interest, and, you know, just like everything else, you know, we go back to the 80s and 90s, but I think that Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games, I think all of that has exploded. And I think, again, it gets you out of, and I love video games too, without a doubt, but I think it forces you to have a different interaction with people and to get your mind thinking in more creative ways and problem solving that certainly enhances your analytical skills as you become an intelligence analyst.
All right, very good. Well, all right, last segment of the show is Words to the World, and this is where I give the guest the last word. Brennan, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
Well, I think we touched on it a little bit, Jason. One thing I want to circle back to is understanding operation. And as a good analyst, certainly get, you know, build your foundation on your analytic techniques and your intelligence methodologies and your databases. And when you got that all figured out, figure out a way to get another foot into operations, whether that's, again, going out with them on ride-alongs, working cases, going to court, what have you. Start to understand the mindset of an investigator, and then you can proactively provide the support for those cases even before they know they need it themselves. So I think that's something to grow on is for the analysts that are out there.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Brennan. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.